This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
Dear God and Father, I thank you that we are able to be here and consider matters that are important to you. Lord, we pray that you will give us discernment and wisdom as we look at some of the very roots of Western culture and thought, and help us, Lord, to be right in our evaluations, to build on the foundation of these thinkers when they have laid the foundation well, and to be critical of them where they have not. We pray, Lord, that you will direct all of our own thinking, that it might be in accordance with your word. We pray in Jesus' name and for his sake. Amen. All right. I told you at the end of the last hour that we were moving on to Plato and Aristotle, thinkers that I consider to be much greater thinkers than the previous ones, but of course, the pre-Socratic thinkers were important. They laid foundations, they raised questions, and Plato certainly couldn't have done what he did without that, without his predecessors. So, but now we have to move on. Some philosophers have drawn together the strands, the ideas of their predecessors, and developed larger systems of thought, trying to accommodate some of the ideas that preceded them and also adding some of their ideas to the mix. Plato is the first, I think, systematic philosopher trying to understand a wide range of problems, trying to come up with a system that incorporates room for a lot of different kinds of insights. So you see on the lecture outline, Plato, I say, is the first great philosophical synthesis, trying to do justice to all sides of the issues, convinced that there must be absolute truth, but seeking also to do justice to change, plurality, non-being, and the limits of understanding. Plato, of course, was a disciple of Socrates, and we often find in his writings dialogues between Socrates and other people, some of them philosophers, some of them not. A number of the dialogues are between Socrates and the sophists trying to set forth their view that knowledge is relative, that there is no universal truth, and so on. And Socrates defending the notion that there is universal truth, that there is genuine knowledge. And this is Plato's concern too. Plato is trying to meet the challenge of the sophists. It's always important when you're studying philosophy to have a pretty good idea who they're against, who are their chief opponents. And Plato's chief opponent during this time would be the sophist movement, as we described it in the last hours, the sophists who called knowledge itself into question. Plato thought that was very dangerous, that if you can't claim that there is an objective, universal kind of knowledge, you may as well not do philosophy anymore at all, and you really don't have any kind of way to show light to shed on your path. So Plato has this epistemological concern for truth and for knowledge, yet he's aware that we make a lot of mistakes. He's aware that our brains and our reasoning is not always reliable, particularly our sense experience. All this epistemic equipment, as Alvin Plantinga calls it, our senses, our reason, our brains, everything that goes into producing knowledge, those things usually work pretty well for us day-to-day matters. But they don't always work right, and sometimes they miss their mark. And so Plato wants to do justice both to knowledge and to ignorance, both to truth and to error. He wants to show why it is that we sometimes get insights and knowledge, how it is that we sometimes fail to do that, rationalism and irrationalism. What he does is to show, he develops a system, develops a perspective in which there are two different worlds. Now, I know there are some Plato scholars who call this in question, and tell you the truth, I'm not completely up to date on Plato scholarship or Aristotelian scholarship or any other scholarship. I don't major in the knowledge of these people. What I'm doing in this course is to give you more or less the standard interpretations of the philosophers, of Plato, of Aristotle, and so on, because it's those standard interpretations that has influenced later thinkers. So Plato believed, Plato distinguished our experience into two different worlds. Well, that two-world understanding is what Plato's successors affirmed or reacted against one way or the other. And so this is what Plato is famous for. And so I'm going to expound that to you without getting into too much detail so far as the text is concerned and without citing any particular brand of Plato scholarship. So there are two worlds, all right? The world, we might call it the world of form, and the world of matter. The material world, the formal world. The difference between form and matter is fairly simple. Here I have a table. Why is it that I'm always talking about tables? Well, because I'm in a room full of tables and not much else. But here we have a table. And it's made of stuffs, probably some kind of plastic, though it's made to look like wood. And so I can talk about its material nature. I can talk about what it's made of. But I can also talk about what that material has been formed into. That material has been placed in a rectangular shape. It's been made flat. It's been placed on legs. And it's put together in such a way as to make it easy to write on, so it has a purpose. The form is what takes the matter and shapes it in order to meet a certain purpose. And that's the basic difference between form and matter. Now, Plato thought that we could find matter all around us in this world. But if we're going to understand what the matter has been formed into, if you want to understand the nature of a table, if you want to know what a table really is, what its essence is, well, you can't find it down here. There's no such thing on this earth as an essential table, as a perfect table. A table that defines all the other tables. See, that's Plato has pretty strict criteria for determining that. So he thought that the forms actually exist in a different world. Let's put it this way. Let's look at triangles. Through all our lives, we've seen triangles, haven't we? We've seen three-sided figures. Probably when you took plane geometry, you saw triangles all over the place. But chances are you've never seen an absolutely perfect triangle. There's usually some little The lines aren't perfectly straight. The angles don't add up to precisely 180 degrees. And most of the triangles that we write freehand are not very good triangles at all. That's the way I draw a triangle. But somehow, we know what a perfect triangle is, don't we? We know that a perfect triangle is a figure that has three sides, and the sides are perfectly straight. The angles add up to 180 degrees. Where can we find that? I mean, we've never seen a perfect triangle on this earth. How do we know then what a perfect triangle is? Well, there is a perfect triangle up here in the world of forms. And Plato develops some mythology here. He says, well, one time we lived up in this world of forms and we observed the perfect triangles, and so we're able to notice imperfect triangles down here in this world of our experience and relate the imperfect triangles to perfect triangles. Let's look at this. Let's follow the outline through a little bit. The two worlds. First, the world of our sense experience. This is what I call the world of matter here. And this is the world that we perceive with our eyes and our ears and our nose, with our senses. Now, as I mentioned before, from sense experience, we can't gain absolutely certain knowledge. There are such things as optical illusions. Our senses sometimes deceive us so that a straight stick appears bent when it's halfway in the water. So our eyes deceive us. We think that it's bent when it's really straight. But somehow we have the ability to correct the mistakes of sense experience. That is, we have this quality called reason that enables us to say, hey, that stick is in the water, so it must be really a straight stick rather than a bent stick. Reason corrects us. So when we see a triangle that's imperfect, our reason tells us what a triangle really is, really what it ought to be. So there must be, a world in which there are perfect triangles, where there are perfect straightness, and indeed where there's perfect virtue, where there's perfect justice, where there's perfect fairness, where there's perfect goodness. And we don't see that here. We never see perfect justice in this world. We never see perfect goodness. We never see perfect virtue. But that must exist somewhere, because we've gotten the idea. We sort of know what justice is. We know what goodness is. And where is that? Where is that located? Well, Plato says the realm where that is located, we'll call it the form. Perfect manhood. Perfect womanhood, perfect greenness. And unlike the world in which we're living in now, the world of forms is perfectly knowable. And it's perfectly knowable through the faculty of reason. We used to live in this world of forms. That's why we remember what a perfect triangle is. But somehow, there was a fall. Is Plato dimly recollecting the biblical picture? I don't know. This is not at all what the Bible presents, but there was a fall, according to Plato. We were living up here. We fell down here. And part of the fall is that we're now encumbered by material bodies. See, in Platonism, matter is not a good thing. So we're encumbered by these material bodies, and yet we remember something of this world. We remember, we have maybe a dim recollection or maybe a more vivid recollection, so that we kind of know what a perfect triangle is, or what perfect justice is, or what a perfect tree might be, or what a perfect human being might be. And so Plato says that essentially what knowledge is reminiscence or recollection, okay? Knowledge is not something that you get through your senses. Your senses really can't tell you anything much. But your senses sometimes remind you of something that you know already. Your senses bring to mind something that you learned when you lived in the world of forms. In one of Plato's books, Plato's books are dialogues between Socrates and other people. And there's one of these dialogues called the Meno. And in the Meno, Socrates brings a slave into the conversation, and he proves through Socratic questioning, through leading questions, that the slave has a knowledge of geometry, even though he didn't study geometry. You know, draw something in the sand and ask the slave, is this line equal to this line, and so on. And pretty soon, through Socrates' carefully devised questions, he gets the slave to give true answers in terms of Euclid's geometry. Well, how did the slave get this information? How did he gain a knowledge of geometry? Well, Plato's answer is that he once lived in the world of forms, and he recollects all of this. Knowledge is recollection. Knowledge is reminiscence. The world of the forms is the world of the changeless, okay? Matter is the world that is changing. There are a number of other things that might help you to know. Here's the forms. Here's the material world. The forms are knowable, supremely knowable. The material world is unknowable. The forms are unchanging. The material world is changing. World of the forms is one. The world of the matter is many. Now, that may surprise you a little bit, because I've talked about plurality in the world of forms, but for Hegel, the forms are arranged in kind of a hierarchical way, and the highest of the forms is called the form of the good. And all the other forms partake of goodness. They're sort of subcategories of goodness. So the good is the main thing in the world of the forms, and it's almost like all the other forms are united in the idea of the good. So, the forms is a realm of being. Material world is a world of non-being. Forms are concepts. Material world is the world of precepts, percepts. That is, the forms are understood by reason, and the material world is understood by sense. The forms serve as criteria or standards. Like goodness, perfect goodness is the standard of all other goodness. Perfect triangularity is the standard of all other triangularity. Perfect justice is the standard for all other justice. So the forms serve as criteria or standards. They are perfections, and matter is imperfect. The forms are reality. Material objects are images, that is, images of the forms. Okay, my poor triangle here is an image of the really perfect triangle in the world of forms. That's the general relationship between the two realms. And you can see how Plato is combining ideas from his predecessors, oneness of Parmenides, the manyness of the atomists, reason, sense, experience, emphases of different thinkers who came before Plato. The world of forms accounts for our knowledge of everything. The world of matter accounts for the fact that we often fail to know. We often fail to understand. So everything is, he brings in the thoughts of his predecessors into one big system. I should tell you a little bit about Plato's doctrine of creation. I noticed I told you about his view of the fall, didn't I? There's also a kind of view that looks a little bit like biblical creation, and indeed the church father, Justin Martyr, thought this was the same thing as biblical creation. He said he thought that Plato must have gotten this idea of creation from Moses. I don't think that's the case. I think that these are very different ideas, but there's kind of a parallel because, of course, the Greeks were interested in determining where all this came from. You know, even if you go back to Thales and Anaximander and others, they were interested in what this world is made of and where it came from and what the processes were that brought it down to the present day. So there's a dialogue, a book that Plato wrote called the Timaeus. The Timaeus is mostly a long speech by somebody, and it's a little hard to tell whether Plato regarded this as myth or whether he took it seriously as an account of the making of the earth. But sometimes Plato, I mean, we talked about that with Parmenides earlier, how these Greek philosophers preferred to present their philosophies as rational ideas, but every now and then when things got a little difficult, they had recourse to mythology. And maybe this is what Plato is doing here. It's hard to know. But what he says is that there is this godlike figure, which he calls the Demiurge. Demiurge, Demiurgos, a finite god, not the Lord of heaven and earth that we believe in, but a finite god who undertakes to make a copy of the world of forms. You can think of him like an artist. Think of him like a sculptor who tries to take a human figure and make a copy of that human figure in stone or clay. Or think of him like a painter who tries to take a scene and reproduce it on canvas. Well, here's the Demiurge trying to take all these wonderful forms and come up with a reproduction of them using matter, using the stuff that we have down here. So he makes a copy. This matter, various terminology for it. One term that you find in the Timaeus is receptacle. And the receptacle is like the canvas, or it's like the clay. And it's basically the same as matter. Matter is the receptacle. So the Demiurge is trying to make a copy of the forms in terms of matter. Now, what is the receptacle? What is matter? Well, that's very hard to say. The matter, by definition, is formless because it gets its forms from the Demiurge. But, what is it? What makes it so that it receives form? That's very clear, very unclear in Plato's writing. But since it receives form, it seems to be that this matter is formless. But if it's formless in Plato's thought, how can it have any being at all? The being of something is its form, okay? The being of this thing is its tableness. The being of a good person is his goodness, okay? So it becomes very mysterious as to what this is. Without the forms, it has no predicates. Without the forms, it is non-being rather than being. But the receptacle has to be described somehow. It must have some predicates, and so Plato tries to get at that. Now, there's one dialogue where somebody asks Plato, Plato, are there forms for mud, hair, and filth? Okay? That's a very difficult question for Plato to answer, because Plato's idea of the world of forms is that they're all clean and they're all beautiful. And they don't have anything of decay about them. So how can there be a form of filth? How can there be a form of dirtiness? Because the forms are perfectly clean. For that matter, how can there be a form of motion? Because the forms are all perfectly stable, perfectly unchanging. How can there be perfect forms of an imperfect world? So here we have this demiurge, and he's trying to make his sculpture, he's trying to make his portrait, but he can't do it. He can't do it perfectly because he's limited by this. The matter limits the form. You know, it's like you can't make a person out of clay. You can try to make an image of a person out of clay, but there's an awful lot of things in a person that you can't reduce to clay. And the same thing for canvas. So you can't make a perfect image of the world of form. So what the demiurge does is makes imperfect images. And of course, that imperfection is the source of our ignorance. It's the reason why we can't know anything perfectly. And of course, ultimately, this is the source of evil. This is the source of the filthiness of the world, the muddiness of the world, the evil of the world in every sense. So the demiurge, although we might want to compare him to the biblical God, he's very different from the biblical God. He's limited by matter. He can't do everything. He can't make a perfect world. And he's limited to the forms. He can't make the world any way he wants to. He can only make the world according to what the forms dictate to him. So he shapes the world by applying pre-existing forms to pre-existent receptacle. He doesn't create any of this out of nothing the way the biblical God does. The forms and the matter are pre-existent, and the demiurge just conforms to their nature. He does with the forms what he can do, and he does with the matter what he can do. And so he's very different from the biblical God. This, I think, indicates the main problems in Plato's philosophy. As you see under four in the summary, Plato's system, I want to say, is both rationalistic and irrationalistic. The world of forms is the world where rationalism prevails. Forms are perfectly knowable. There can be no mistakes up here. The material world is where everything is mistaken, basically. I mean, everything down here is defective. nothing down here measures up to anything up here. So this is where reason fails. You know, the image of the cave that he gives in one of his dialogues, we're looking at shadows and we're not looking at the real thing. We're just constantly confused by the images that we see. But the idea is that the forms account for the world that we live in. That the fact that there is a perfect triangle in the world of forms makes it possible for there to be imperfect triangles in this world. The perfect triangle explains the imperfect triangles. Perfect goodness explains the existence of lesser goodness. Because everything down here is kind of an image of what's up here. Remember, it's not a very good image. This world, the goodness down here, doesn't perfectly reflect the goodness up here. The conclusion you have to come to is that the world of forms does not account for everything down here. The world of forms accounts only for the positive things down here. The world of forms doesn't account for the imperfection. The world of forms doesn't account for the mud, hair, and filth. Okay? The world of forms doesn't account for our ignorance. The world of forms does not account for evil. The world of forms does not give us a perfectly rational account of the world in which we're living. The world of matter becomes the world in which irrationalism prevails. Now, what's happening here is that Plato is claiming knowledge of an irrational world, a world that can't be known. And this is the problem that every non-Christian thinker has in reconciling rationalism with irrationalism. You're taking a perfect knowledge, trying to impose it on an unknowable world, okay? It's a world that's chaotic. And here are your rational categories. Here's the grid that you try to use. You try to use the grid to interpret this irrational world. And it never fits, okay? You can't take a grid that's appropriate only to a perfect world and impose that on an imperfect world. And so knowledge always escapes our grasp. The world of forms is not sufficient to give us the knowledge that we need. And so we're lost either in a kind of rationalism or in a kind of irrationalism. Well, we come to Aristotle now. Aristotle, the chief student of Plato. Aristotle also works with the concepts of form and matter, but Aristotle turns Plato upside down, or he demythologizes Plato, if you will. Aristotle just says, let's get rid of this world of forms up here. That's too mythological. Let's get rid of it. It's not a rational idea. Nobody's ever been there. Nobody knows anything about that world. That's sort of like pie in the sky. So let's get rid of it. But, says Aristotle, the distinction between form and matter is still a useful one. As I told you before, this table is matter, but it takes a form. Now, where is the form? Well, the form is not up in the sky somewhere. It's not in a different world. The form is down here. The form is in the table. So Aristotle says that form and matter are both found down here. Form and matter are both found in our experience. You don't need to have two different worlds. The forms exist in our own world, and the forms exist together with matter. So that's Aristotle's main concept. Form and matter are always found together, with one exception, the exception of the prime mover, which we'll talk about in a minute. But for the most part, form and matter are found together. The form of the table is in the table. The form of the tree is in the tree. The form of the man is in the man. The form is simply the shape, the characteristics, the attributes that the matter takes. Now, Aristotle's primary metaphysical concept is substance. Substance is that which exists in itself, he says. He's developing his philosophy in an analogy with grammar, okay? In a grammatical sentence, typically you have a subject and you have a predicate. You say the table is brown, all right? Well, the table is the subject, brown is the predicate. And the substance is what can go in the subject spot. The substance is what exists in itself, and then the predicates are the things that attach to it, the things that become part of it, the attributes or the accidents. You can have a table that's not brown. It would still be a table. So the table is the thing that exists in itself. The brownness may be part of it or may not be. Brownness, of course, you can't have that just by itself. Brownness has to exist in something. So the brownness doesn't exist by itself, but the table exists by itself. The table is what can go in the subject slot. And the most common substances are individual things like chairs and tables and trees and animals and persons. And each substance is composed of both form and matter, except for the divine substance, except for the prime mover or God, who is pure form. Again, we'll talk about that later on. The form is what gives to every substance its shape, its size, its qualities. And indeed, it also gives, I didn't mention this in the outline, but the form gives to every substance its purpose, all right? A great part of the form of the table is that it's for writing. It has the purpose of being a writing surface. So that's part of the form, and that's important to the nature of the table. Indeed, that's what tells you what the table is. If you want to know what the table is, you don't ask what it's made of. You don't ask about the plastic and the paints and the varnishes and so on. You don't ask for all the material things. If you want to know what the table is, you ask its purpose. What's it for? And that's the form. The table has this table quality, and the table quality is what enables you to write on it. Well, so form gives to every substance its shape, size, and qualities, and things are knowable because of their form, okay? To know that object is to know its tableness, to know its form. Matter is that which is formed. Matter is what receives form. Matter is that on which the form operates. Now, if that's the case, what is matter? Can you ask what matter is apart from form? If this table is just pure matter without any form, can you describe it? No, not really, because descriptions are always formal. Without a form, the table is not hard, it's not soft, it's not brown, it's not yellow, it's not tall, it's not short. Apart from form, it's what? It's nothing, okay? It's non-being. Without form, it has no qualities. Without form, it's an irrational thing. It doesn't really exist. So, but nevertheless, you want to say that matter is something, because as with Plato, the matter resists perfection, okay? This is not a perfect table, because it's a material object, and the material object can't be shaped into a perfect table. So the table is a table because of its form. Form is attached to the matter, but there's no way of saying what that matter is. That's a real problem, you see, for Aristotle and for Plato. The form and the matter are supposed to fit together easily, but they resist one another. They pull one another apart. The form is somehow perfect, the matter is imperfect. And all of these things that we said about the difference between Plato's forms and Plato's matter, these all pertain to Aristotle too. The form is knowable, the matter is unknowable. The form is unchanging, the matter is changing. The form is one, the matter is many. The form is being, the matter is non-being. So the form really doesn't do its job, okay? The form is supposed to make the matter clear and knowable and understandable. The form is to give an account of the matter. But the matter, by its very nature, cannot be described. It cannot be given an account of. So again, you have trying to impose a system of rationality upon a basically irrational universe. And this is trying to escape from this rational-irrational dialectic, which we've been talking about in connection with our theological analysis. Now look at number 5 here on your outline, potentiality and actuality. This is Aristotle's account of change. And we recall how difficult a problem that is for the Greek philosophers to understand change. It seems almost irrational. Well, Aristotle is trying to give a rational account of change, and what he does is he resolves it into a relationship between potentiality and actuality. Everything except God again. Everything has both potentiality and actuality. Has anybody ever talked to you and said, hey, you're a potential pastor, you're a potential theologian? That doesn't mean that you're a pastor now, but it means you have the ability to become a pastor. And so we often talk about young kids having a great potential. You know, I think there was a cartoon with Charlie Brown where Charlie says there's no bigger, I think it was Linus actually who says this, that there's no greater burden than having a great potential. Aristotle sees this pattern of potential versus actuality throughout the universe. For example, take an oak tree. You have the acorn, and the acorn is potentially the tree. And that means basically the acorn has the form of the tree, because the form is in the process of shaping that acorn. So that it grows the way a tree is supposed to grow, and given the right amount of care, given the right opportunity, it becomes a mature tree. Aristotle applies that model pretty well across the board. Things have their potential, and through that potential, they move and they change and they grow until they reach the goal, the telos, the purpose for which they were made, through which they came into being. Aristotle pretty generally describes change in these terms. When anything changes, it's moving from being potentially here to being actually here. That process is called a movement from potentiality to actuality. And that's the way that you can see basically static forms and basically static matter engaging in motion, because the matter kind of strives somehow to realize the form. to become what it's destined to be. So as things become more and more actualized, the form predominates over the matter. The less actualized things are, the more potentiality they have, or some translations read potency, the more, in that case, the more the matter predominates over the form. But then when the actualization takes place, the form predominates over the matter. So the acorn, in terms of matter, it's some, it's various kinds of organic stuff, cells. But what it really is, the form that it has, is the form of the oak tree. And so the processes, the changes that it goes through, are the changes by which it realizes its potential, by which it becomes what it essentially is. Now we come to Aristotle's doctrine of the prime mover. The prime mover is the explanation of change. Now, why is it that these potentials keep becoming actual? Why is it that acorns keep striving to become oaks? Why is it that people in this location move over to this location? I mean, it's the form that they're realizing, but why do we realize these forms? And the answer is a kind of God. This God is what Aristotle calls the prime mover, and people have often compared this prime mover to the Christian God, just as they compare Plato's demiurge to the Christian God. As we saw, the demiurge of Plato is very different from the God of the Bible, but that's also true, I think, of Plato's, of Aristotle's God. Of course, Aristotle's God is, Thomas Aquinas, the great medieval philosopher, later on took Aristotle's arguments for the prime mover, and he made them into arguments for the biblical God. So there's kind of a parallel here, but nevertheless, I think these are very different divine beings. The prime mover, Aristotle's prime mover, accounts for change. He accounts for the constant motion, constant movement from potentiality to actuality. He is the ultimate cause of motion, but he is not himself moved. Otherwise, he would require a more ultimate cause. So Aristotle uses arguments here that Thomas Aquinas would later use to prove the existence of the biblical God. You need a cause, okay? This is the causal argument or the cosmological argument. If something takes place in this world, there has to be something that caused it. There has to be something that caused that. There has to be something that caused that. And you can't keep going back to infinity. If you do, then you never reach the final cause. You never reach the ultimate cause. So you have to stop somewhere. You have to find the cause that caused all these other causes. And that cause will be the uncaused cause. That cause will be the motion that is unmoved. So there's a mover that is unmoved, and we call that the prime mover. Aristotle believes that that being is the ultimate cause of motion. He is not, you sort of wonder, I mean, Aristotle does use religious language to describe this being and talks about him in personal characteristics, but it's not clear why. I mean, why is this being considered to be personal? All Aristotle proves, if he proves anything, is that this God is the source of motion. But why do you have to have a personal being to be a source of motion? And again, this being, although Aristotle sometimes uses personal language about him, is not fully personal. He Aristotle describes him as God, but the argument demonstrates only an impersonal principle of change. To this being are ascribed the attributes of Parmenidean being, unchangeability, indestructibility, and so on. But the prime mover is not personally concerned with the world. The prime mover does not know the world. The prime mover does not love the world. So he's basically an impersonal force. And that's what I told you some hours ago, that it's only in the Bible that there is a supreme being who is a personal absolute. You don't find that in Hinduism, you don't find that in Buddhism, you don't find it in Plato, and you don't find it in Aristotle. Aristotle's God is not personal. He doesn't know the world, he doesn't speak to the world, he doesn't think about the world. Why is that? Well, because if he thought about the world, then the world would be influencing him. And that can't be. He has to be the sole cause. We can't have the world causing God. God causes the world. Can't have it working the other way around. So how does the prime mover move things? Well, he doesn't give them a shove, because that would be getting involved in the world, you see. He causes things to move because they are attracted to him. It's a little bit like if you go to a rock concert and there's this lead singer of the rock band, and he's up there on the stage and he's singing, and all the ladies are falling down and swooning and crying and all of that. He looks like he doesn't even know that they're there, you know. I mean, he doesn't make them cry. He doesn't make them come forward. He doesn't make them swoon. But they're so attracted to him that that's what they do. They swoon, they fall down, they cry. And it's sort of like that with Aristotle's prime mover. All the world is attracted to this wonderful being. All the world is attracted to him, so that they move in this way or that way. And all the motion that exists in the universe can be explained as things being attracted to the prime mover. Aristotle's prime mover, of course, is very different from the Christian God. He's purely formal. He's not personal. Because in the final analysis, Aristotle's God is threatened by the world. See, if Aristotle's God were to know the world, then the world would be causing changes in his mind. If Aristotle's God were to love the world, then the world would be causing changes in his affections. But you don't find that in Christianity. You don't find that in the Bible. The God of the Bible is not threatened in that kind of way. The God of the Bible can know the world without the world threatening his existence at all. Because the God of the Bible has not just caused the world, has not just brought about the motion of the world, but the God of the Bible has created the world out of nothing. So that everything that the world does, all the motions, all the love, all the hatred, everything that the world does has already come out of his eternal plan and out of his creative power. So God is able to know the world. God is able to love the world without the world affecting him in the same way he affects them. And so, again, Aristotle, like Plato, has not come to the point where Scripture is with regard to God. I should say a little bit about human knowledge. That's number 7 on your outline, epistemology. Aristotle is a little bit more empiricist than Plato is. Aristotle has more respect for human sense experience than Plato did. And so he believes that human knowledge is a process by which the mind abstracts forms from concrete things. There's the table. There's the substance, the thing that I want to investigate. Through my mind, through my senses, I see what the table is. I see its qualities. And then the mind, which is active as well as passive, it's passive in that it receives the images through my senses, but it's active in that the mind looks at those images and tries to discern what the table is for. What's the form that makes the table what it is? And through the mind, through the intellect, through the active intellect, we come to those kinds of conclusions. So we don't need to live in the world of the forms. This is the world of the forms. We live down here. We make our judgments about what things are. We take the forms from the trees and from the people and from justice and from tables and chairs and so on. And thereby we gain a knowledge of what this world is like. I wish I could spend more time on Aristotle. He's a very impressive figure, and of course Thomas Aquinas makes use of Aristotle's thought in great detail in his theology. But we've got at least the outline before us. We know in general what Aristotle does with his view of knowledge and with his view of the nature of the world, his metaphysics.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.